Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with John Mitrofanis. John is a world-leading researcher on the impact of photobiomodulation and neurodegenerative disease. His work has been centered around seeking effective, drug-free treatments and preventative measures for Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. A former professor of anatomy at the University of Sydney, John is now based in France, where he works at the biomedical research centre Clinatech. John is beginning exciting work on biophoton release, examining how photobiomodulation might alter the release of these photons from neurons and other cell types. In his book, Run in the Light, John outlines the most current understanding of the pathologies involved in Parkinson's disease, and how both exercise and photobiomodulation can be used as inexpensive, simple, and essentially no-risk modalities to prevent and delay the progression of the disease. John is extremely humble and open-minded, important qualities needed to explore deep scientific questions. John was also guest number 3 on the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast, so if you want to hear our first conversation, go back and download that one first and then you can catch up here. With all this being said, I really hope you enjoy this episode. John, thank you for coming back to speak with me a little bit more. You were one of the first guests on my podcast, so I really appreciate you coming back on and allowing me to ask you a few more questions.
Yes, of course, with pleasure.
We were just talking a little bit about biophotons, and I've been very interested in the biological relevance of this phenomenon. And I was wondering how you came to understand that this was actually going on, because it's quite niche at the moment. Not many people know that our cells are emitting all sorts of wavelengths of light, albeit in very small amounts, but the emission is there. So how did you first stumble upon this notion?
I was talking to a good friend of mine, Anne Liebert, and she's a physiotherapist that's have a very keen interest in red and near-infrared light therapy for the treatment of she's a physio, so she started with peripheral issues, musculoskeletal, reducing inflammation. And then she developed an interest in treating Parkinson's disease patients with this treatment. And that's how we had the contact. And one day we were having coffee, and she mentioned something about light being emitted by cells. And then she went on, and that sort of stuck with me. And I said, well, hang on a minute, Anne, what are you talking about? I sort of viewed it as like an autofluorescence.
Mm.
And that was the first I heard of it. And she drew my attention to this biphoton concept. And then I started looking into it a little bit more. The idea was floated about 100 years ago with this fellow who was looking at the growth patterns of onion buds, and noticed that one, if you put a thick glass plate between them, then they wouldn't grow as fast as they would if the plate wasn't there. So he thought there was some kind of communication, and subsequently that was shown to be light, some sort of electromagnetic communication between them. And with the development of far more sophisticated detection systems over the last 15, 20 years, it's been shown that that all living cells will emit light at different wavelengths, anything from ultraviolet through to the infrared range. It's incredibly weak. We can't see it. A fluorescence microscope, a normal fluorescence microscope, is not able to see it.
Yeah.
If you have a very, very high-powered camera system, what they call a photomultiplier, that will increase the detection system of the photons, that you could pick it up. And as we were talking earlier, it's very few photons from any given cell. We're talking 20 less than 20 cells, 20 photons per cell. So it's very, very weak. Mm. And I think what I just opening up a bracket, and I think I've discussed this with you before, that I never really could understand why red and near-infrared light treatment would work, particularly on cells so deep in the brain, for instance, that yeah. normally work in darkness. Why would they have receptors for those wavelengths, yeah. particularly the mitochondria? You know, it never made sense to me in the 15 years I've been associated with this type of treatment. But the penny dropped when I came to understand about the biophoton concept. They're receptive to those wavelengths of light because they use light to communicate with each other. And they would give light, different wavelengths of light, to either repair themselves or as a state of good health. And that would be their way of communication. And it seems that if they're giving off red or infrared, that means they're healthy and they're happy. But if it's more blue and ultraviolet, then they're more in distress. That seems to be the go. And one thing we're looking at here at Fons Klinotech at Grenoble is this a real phenomenon? Do they emit different wavelengths to indicate their state of health? Like I said earlier, we've just got the setup going, and I hope to report to you in about 6 months that something like that's going on.
That's so fascinating.
And the other thing I just want to mention, and everybody I've spoken to this about, they've just been stunned.
Yeah.
Neuroscientists or lay people, they've just been stunned. Really? Light communication, the idea that a metabolic reaction by the mitochondria would give off light. And that is stunning, and I was quite taken aback by it. But when you think about it, and I think I've said this to you before, we were made by light.
Yeah.
That was the energy that made us. When you think about it that way, you think, well, it's not that extraordinary that we would, the cells would still use light and we would give off light as part of our life.
Yeah, and I mean, it's really interesting to think back to Gerwich and the onion experiments that all cells are emitting this light, this ultra weak photon emission. And like you said, we're talking, you know, under 100 photons per second per centimeter square, I believe. You know, this is sort of the realm that it's in. And the wavelengths range, you know, there's a broad range, like you said, all the way from UV to infrared. And it seems to me, based on my albeit brief reading of the literature, that these wavelengths are basically communication devices that happen at the fastest speed possible, which is really good in trying to signal. And I try and think of it like a projector. If you have a projector showing a movie, if you have all the signal perfect, you can understand what the movie is showing and you'll get the story. Whereas if some of that is being disrupted and you take out certain colors and you take out certain wavelengths, the story gets disturbed and you can't actually understand what's going on. I think that's sort of, to me, it seems like that's the story of modern disease, is that this story of light being emitted by our cells is being disturbed, and our signals between all of our cells are being disturbed. And my understanding is that the photon emission is coupled to oxidative reactions, redox reactions, particularly lipid peroxidation in the membranes of the cells, releasing light. And it just seems obvious that that's a signal to all of the surrounding cells saying, hey, here's what's going on. This wavelength represents this at this time. And that's how everyone knows what's going on. That's how all the coordinated things inside the cell actually happen. And it happens at light speed, which is fantastic. We kind of need that speed to happen. And this sort of brings me to this question that I've wanted to ask you for a long time, is that clearly we have even UV light being emitted, which is absolutely crazy. We have very, very powerful photons being emitted, albeit in small amounts, but still they're being created by our cells. Is this coupled with the fact that the substantia nigra in the brain is covered in neuromelanin? You know, why do we have all of these internal melanins? We have it in the eye, we have it in the cochlea, in the ear, we have it in the brain, in the pineal gland. All of these internal melanins, which kind of don't make sense if melanin's only job is to protect from, short wavelength light from the sun. Why would it be inside the brain? And I think this is sort of this big conundrum that biophotons actually can help make sense of. Is the melanin, the neuromelanin in the brain, there to receive signals from biophotons?
That is an interesting way of looking at things. That neuromelanin is very different to the melanin that you'd find in the skin, because, as you may know, it's a byproduct of catecholamine production.
Which I found to be very interesting to find out that you can make it from dopamine.
Or any catecholamine, So the noradrenergic cells in Locus coeruleus would are picked up. In fact, if you looked at a brain stem, you could actually see the streak of pigmented cells with the naked eye. I mean, it's that distinct.
Yeah.
Some people think that that's there as a protection, as you said. Other people think that it may be toxic. It may turn toxic and make these cells a little bit more vulnerable to any kind of stress. But the idea that they could be there to soak up the biophotons, I never really thought about it. I mean, that's a good way of looking at it. And whether these cells are more active in terms of the biophoton communication, I don't know. And maybe they use it as a way of their particular brand of communication and reception of the light. I don't know.
I've seen some hypotheses that when melanin interacts with light, it's able to essentially split water into oxygen and hydrogen. And I haven't seen the experimental evidence, it has been claimed that happens. And I wonder about these trials that are going on, particularly in Asia, with hydrogen-rich water to treat Parkinson's disease. And I wonder, because melanin in the brain is lost in states of Parkinson's disease, is this a reason why enriched hydrogen water sort of helps combat that, because it's actually supplementing what is being lost by that melanin inside the brain? Perhaps it's also why shining red light on that part of the brain also has those effects, because it's engaging in creating molecular hydrogen in the brain, which is quite important as an antioxidant.
I wasn't aware of this Asian study with using
There are a few trials going on at the moment using hydrogen water to treat Parkinson's. And also there was one that I found that's using hydrogen water and photobiomodulation concomitantly to treat Parkinson's disease. So there does seem to be this connection. I haven't read the literature enough to know why they came to the conclusion that molecular hydrogen is a good thing for that particular type of neurodegeneration, but clearly there's enough information out there for them to try it. And it just makes me think, well, if a loss of neuromelanin is one of the key things that's going on in Parkinson's disease, perhaps you're losing the ability to generate certain molecules from an interaction with light. That's a very long bow to draw, but to my knowledge, there's not really a good explanation as to why neuromelanin is lost in the substantia nigra in Parkinson's disease.
Well, the cells are lost.
Mm.
So, you know, if the cells are lost, then that would go. God knows what happens to them. It's probably picked up probably somewhere. But the hydrogen, I mean, the... one of the theories that red or infrared light may work is that it's absorbed by water within the cells. So that could be a reason why the coupling happens. But this is all. You've been a fountain of new information, Cameron.
I've been quite obsessed over all of this for a few years. So yeah, I've been very, very interested in trying to figure out what's going on, because yeah. I also found out that people with Parkinson's disease are at an increased risk of melanoma, which to me screams a disorder of the pigmentary system that's going on, that's largely mediated by exposure to light, which sort of ties in this whole biophotons, red light therapy, why all of these things are being considered around the disease. And have you heard of Scott Zimmerman's work? He's been working with Glenn Jeffrey a little bit recently.
Go on.
He's an optical engineer, and he's recently turned to biology, and he has been looking at the body and realizing that basically we're just a biological photon trap. You know, we are designed to funnel light deep, deep within us. And him and Glenn's colleague, Bob Fosbury, have been doing incredible work looking at how deep into the body near infrared light can go, because water is a weak absorber of near infrared light, whereas in the infrared, it's a strong absorber in particular bands. So the near infrared actually has this unique ability to traverse a long way inside the body by bouncing off lots of stuff on the way. And Scott wrote a paper that showed that the folds of the brain actually, like a light guide, and that's the word that he used, that they actually funnel light deep, deep within the brain, particularly these near infrared wavelengths, and they're actually making it basically all the way in. And of course, we can't see it because it's invisible to us, but he has shown that this is, you know, this is exactly what's happening, because bone is basically, completely invisible to near infrared light. It doesn't really care about bone. It's not a strong absorber. You see the heme in the veins are really the only strong absorber. And there's amazing near infrared photography that Bob has done to show that the near infrared light essentially just goes straight through all these biological tissues. Not directly, it's bouncing off lots of stuff on the way. But that may also be something that's going on, is light coming into the brain through all those folds like a light trap. And, you know, we live indoors now, that near infrared light is basically all gone unless you're outside. And I made a video a few weeks ago saying that I don't think Glenn Jeffrey and Mike Powner's recent study on showing that red light therapy reduced glucose spikes in a glucose tolerance test. I said, I don't think that would work on a hunter-gatherer, because they are not deficient in that part of the solar spectrum because they live outside. I don't think you'd see the same effects at all. And I said, just like if you get someone who has a severe zinc deficiency, if you give them zinc, they'll do better, of course. I think that's what we're seeing here a lot of the time with red light therapy, is that people are so desperate for those longer wavelengths because we live indoors out of the influence of these long wavelengths, when we should be exposed to them all the time. When you give someone long wavelengths that they've been desperately wanting, of course they're going to respond well to it. And I think that's, to me, that seems like the cornerstone of why photobiomodulation works so well, because we live indoor lives now and we're not exposed to those on a consistent basis anymore. I realized I've been speaking for a very long time. So
they're very interesting thoughts. And, people have just, as you probably know, people are starting to look at making light bulbs and light sources with more red. In fact, I think you can buy them now with a, oh, there you go. it is an interesting idea that really we should be exposed to it, particularly later on in the day when it becomes a little bit infrared richer. We're lacking that. And the fact that we're responding to it, or a lot of people are responding to it, could be the fact that they're starved of it. And I think part of the heterogeneity of this whole thing is you know, maybe it works better in some people that aren't as outdoor going as others. Although Glenn tells me on all his human stuff that he's looked at every metric and he still can't figure out why there's so much heterogeneity in us. Obviously, we're not lab animals and we're not all the same and grown in exactly the same conditions. But he said he's looked at every metric I'm not sure whether he specifically looked at this, but he's looked at a lot of different metrics and he can't figure out why there is considerable heterogeneity. But he could be right. He could be right, you know.
Yeah, I would love to see that tested, but that's not an easy experiment to run to go to, you know, Tanzania and find some hunter-gatherers and do the same thing on them. Do you know why there is a relationship between melanoma and Parkinson's disease? Why there is an increased risk there? No?
I mean, the different types of melanin. In the skin and in the brain, like we said, I've got no idea. If you know, it'd be pure speculation. It's not something that I would comment on, you know. I think we did have to look at the study and think, look how they did it. Some of these public health epidemiology things are a little bit. I've got no doubt that it, but yeah, you'd have to look at it and you think,
I haven't looked at it deeply, but it seems like an interesting association based on the.
I wouldn't be able to make much sense of it. I mean, it could be the fact that they don't walk as, you know, they're more stationary than others, or when they're out, they're more, I don't know.
Yeah, it might be explained by other factors other than, you know, the things that I'm thinking about. And yeah, absolutely, sedentary indoor life could be a risk factor for both that trumps the other ones. How do you think about the fact that melanins have the capacity to be semiconductors and are able to be involved in the electrical system in the brain and on the skin as well?
I don't know that much about it, Cameron. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't think anyone does.
You know, you've asked me some really secret questions from left field that I've got no idea.
It's okay. I don't think anyone knows. I just thought, you know, it's always good to sort of spitball and see if anything sticks to the wall.
No, I don't. All I know about it in the brain, it's made as a byproduct. It could turn toxic or it could be beneficial in mopping up stuff. Other than that, I really can't tell you much more about it. It's not something I've ever really, you know, throughout my life really looked into.
It's very interesting because it seems in the literature there's this constant reinforcement that the only times in life where the melanin in that part of the brain degrades or is not there is right after birth, when motor patterns aren't generated, babies can't, you know, perform well articulated movements. And in old age, when they gradually lose the melanin, lose those cells that are.
Yeah, but isn't it the melanin or is it sort of because they're not making dopamine? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting sort of cause and effect thing, you know, what is going on there actually, you know, rather than just looking at the end and seeing what's going on. You want to know what's causing what and why.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And leave it, Mike. The person, have you spoken to her?
I've reached out to her. She's she's involved in Violight, isn't she?
No. She's not with she's not with them. She's with she has association with some light product, I'm not. Yeah, she's kind of spoken to me a little bit about. She might know a little bit more about it than me.
Yeah.
But she was the one who introduced me to the biophotons, and we wrote a review on it not so long ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, she might be a good person. Just you could mention that you know you've spoken to me and I recommend. Yeah.
Well, for sure. You're getting ready to do some biophoton measurements. In the studies that I've read, they have to use dark adaptation for about 2 hours prior to biophoton measurement to not measure delayed luminescence instead of the actual biophoton emission.
Yes. That's one of the problems we have.
I find it fascinating how unbelievably difficult it is not only to measure the biophoton emission, but to try and understand what wavelengths they are. It seems like such an impossible task. And then you have to deal with this delayed luminescence.
Yeah, yeah.
What how come after being irradiated with light, like after being outside in sunlight, how come our bodies are luminescing after a long period of time after that exposure? And why do you need to be dark adapted before taking biophoton emission measurements?
I think it's because the residual light that you might be given off or from the surrounds. I know that Jamie was telling me that before she does any recording, the lights have to be off for around about an hour or two.
Yeah.
And you know, these are things that you never really think about. You think, really?
Mm.
And they do, because there's still residual photons that you can't see, obviously. Yeah. But they're still there. And she's just bought, we're in the process of getting a filter so we can start making sense of the different wavelengths.
Yeah.
At the moment, she's just doing straight measurements, and the numbers are incredibly low. It's like, yeah, you know, something even less than what you quoted. The ones we're measuring is less than 20.
Yeah,
right. It's not a lot. But yeah, the remarkable thing is that there is a lot of residual light floating around, and it's there and we can't see it. Now, whether that's having an effect on us at doses that can affect us, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, this is all new stuff, Cameron. Yeah. You're asking me questions that I really have no idea about.
Yeah, I remember asking Bob Fosbury about it, and he said he doesn't understand how the body can produce a UV photon. He said it's such a high-powered photon. I don't understand how the body is creating a UV photon. And that's something I've been trying to wrap my head around as well, because I haven't heard any good explanation as to where the energy is coming from to produce a UV photon in the body. And
well, he's a physicist.
Yes. Yeah, so you know, like you said, this is all just so early on. Even though we've known about this for a long time, it's so difficult to actually get a grasp on it, and try and let alone understand what it all means. It's very difficult. What parts of the body are you measuring or looking to measure?
Oh, we're just looking at stuff in the dish at the moment.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So we've got neurons. I think Jamie's doing some fibroblasts. This is Jamie Ho.
Yeah.
Jamie. Neurons, astrocytes. But we're starting with fibroblasts, just skin cells.
Very.
So yeah, that's the starting point, and then the next step is to challenge them with you know, under different conditions, mainly with toxins, see what happens to the firing rate, and see how light, red or infrared light, affects their biophoton production. I think in about 6 months or so, we'll be ready to have a more meatful or a discussion full of a bit more meat.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you're quite knowledgeable about the impact of the changing structure of water when it is exposed to different environmental conditions. And this is something that guys like Jerry Pollack have been quite ridiculed about. But it seems to me quite obvious that there is a change in the structure of this water, whether it's going from bulk water to a more crystalline style water and then back. How has this changed the way that you're looking at this research? You know, the story of water is not just this, you know, amorphous, you know, blob in the cell. It's actually doing things that are quite important for cellular function.
I think the thing that has changed the way I look at things, and it's not a very exciting, you might be disappointed with this, Cameron, but it just drew attention to the fact that cytochrome oxidase C is not the be-all and end-all.
Yeah.
And that there's something else. And Mike Hamblin was published something a few years ago, and he talked about water-gated ion channels or something like that. And I thought, well, you know, what is he talking about? Then this paper came out saying that these mice that have got no cytochrome oxidase C are still receiving the benefits of the red light. And that was a game changer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they said, okay, there must be something else. And I know Bob Fosbury likes the idea of chlorophyll. Mm-hmm. Chlorophyll deposits in cells absorbing the light, which is a lovely idea, but the evidence is a bit thin on the ground.
My knowledge is it's not been replicated.
No, that's just it. I mean, you've got these, I forget where that study was from. It was from the States somewhere. But yeah, that hasn't kicked off, although it's a lovely idea.
Yeah.
And then this German chap, Sommer, he has put out a string of papers on interfacial water and within the mitochondria being less viscous with red light. So I think that's the fact where most people have shifted to, that it's not purely cytochrome oxidase C and that there's other things involved, and it could be more of a water-based thing. I think that's the reason why, a main reason why I've shifted to thinking towards that. And again, it gets back to this thing of, well, God, we were made with this. That's mm-hmm. how we were made. We were made with water and an energy source being light. So it's not too outrageous.
No, if anything, it's more parsimonious. It makes the most sense that those two, that water and light, are the foundation. Everything that's going on inside of us, and perhaps should be the first place we look rather than the last place.
Yeah, the last. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, a lot of medical practitioners, particularly neurologists, are not receptive to this because they're not trained like that to think out of the box.
Yeah.
And I think part of the problem of dealing with something new is that they're not trained to think like that. A lot of them think like, well, I need a drug to activate a receptor, and that's the only thing that will work. And occasionally a surgical technique like deep brain stimulation, of which we're still not clear on how it works. That's a problematic thing. Getting acceptance is so slow through the different communities, particularly the medical community, and because they're trained to think.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you still using red light therapy first thing in the morning based on the work? I think you were co-author on this paper with Glenn about the shifting workloads of mitochondria.
Yes, I have. Here's my helmet.
Yeah.
My daily therapy. This is a coronet. Mm-hmm. Kurt Hamilton and Ron Brown. I was going to say Ron Wood there, but he's in the Rolling Stones, isn't he? No, Ron Brown. So I do my bit. I tend to remember a lot of things from my childhood, which may not necessarily be a good thing, but yeah, I tend to remember stuff, and people who have used it, like Monsieur Benabid, you know, he tells me that he remembers a lot of things from his childhood. And he learned Russian when he was a boy, and he's starting to rekindle his Russian. So, but yes, for some people, for most people, it works. You know, others, it's not so so forthcoming. And I think the fact that you brought up an issue of, well, how exposed to the outside are they, could be a basis for this heterogeneity.
Yeah, definitely. Given that the effects of red light therapy seem to be abscopic, which means you don't have to necessarily apply it to the place that you need the effects, is there any benefit from using a cranial device rather than doing something like the shins, the way you have access to the bone marrow quite well?
I use the analogy of when you're the abscopal effect seems to be working. It seems to activate something, mm-hmm. Whether it be in the immune system or the vascular system, even within the mitochondria themselves, because there's some form of communication between them from different body parts.
I think you also noted that we have discovered free mitochondria in the blood now.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's another issue, a bit like the chlorophyll issue, that people aren't jumping to confirm that.
Right.
I think at best somebody said, well, yeah, they're there, but there's not a lot of them. But again, it's a fascinating idea that these things are floating around. So I think we're waiting for absolute confirmation of this. But the analogy I draw is if you're using the abscopal effect, yes, it would be effective. There may well be heterogeneity in different people, but with the abscopal effect, you're really depending on another system to do your work.
Yeah.
You know, or you're depending on someone else to do a job for you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people don't do it as well as you would like them to do. You know, some people's staffs are better than others. Whereas if you're doing it direct, it's getting straight there.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I had a brain condition, a neurological condition, then I'd be using the helmet straight up. Because I'd know it'd be getting straight to the brain, and we know it does get to the brain because of fMRI studies, EEGs, all sorts of other investigations, spectroscopy. So you know that we know it's getting there. So I'd say, well, why not use the direct system? Mm-hmm. I mean, the abscopal is probably a supplementary thing.
Yeah.
But that would be my view on it. Okay. And from the experiments that I've been involved in, yes, both abscopal and direct work, but the direct was always a little bit better.
Okay, interesting. Have you heard of methylene blue and the trials using it for Parkinson's disease?
Yes. I'm not sure of the mechanism, but I have heard of that.
My understanding is that essentially it's an electron donor to complex one. And using it alongside red light therapy helps accentuate the recycling and the electron donation into the respiratory complex.
Okay. Yep.
What are your thoughts on that? I know methylene blue is quite a divisive topic. Some people are all for it and other people are, you know, trying to stay away from it. Do you have any particular ideas?
I don't know. No, I don't know much about it. I wouldn't be adding anything to it, you know.
Interesting. It might be better not to know anything about it.
Yeah. I know it crosses the blood-brain barrier quite comfortably. But I wouldn't know, Cameron. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm asking questions that I don't think anyone's got the answer to. It's just floating around in my head. I'll finish off by asking what the similarities between Parkinson's and Alzheimer's are. I know you're working on or have worked on both, and I'm wondering what are the similarities. I know there's some gender disparity between Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. I think Alzheimer's is more prevalent in females, and Parkinson's more prevalent in males. I might be getting that mixed up, but what are the unifying similarities, etiological similarities between them, or are there any?
Well, I mean, the literature would tell us that both, if you look at the old way of the traditional way of looking at these things, both their similarities is that they're both considered a neurodegenerative disease in that the cells suffer a cell loss without trauma or ischemia, and that fundamentally that there's an abnormal protein buildup in both of them, where you've got beta amyloid and the tau protein in Alzheimer's, and yet with Parkinson's disease, you've got alpha-synuclein being mischievous, and both have been associated labeled prion diseases, where this abnormal conformation of these proteins spread across the brain. It's fine if one or two of them become abnormal, but it's this viral spread across the brain. But of late, both, particularly for Alzheimer's disease, the concept that you've got beta amyloid as the villain has been questioned.
Yeah.
And that mainly because the drugs, anti-amyloid drugs, have failed terribly,
mm-hmm.
you know, in spectacular failures in the clinic. So now people that my colleague Jonathan Stone has been associated with looking at other ways in which dementia manifests itself. And he's of the view that rather than he and others are of the view that amyloid, rather than being the arsonist, is actually the fireman.
Yeah.
And that it's a protective mechanism, and the only time it's been shown to be toxic has been in at levels which have been way beyond anything we'd see under physiological conditions. And it's true, even anything can be toxic at high doses. Even water can be toxic at high doses. So the idea that the amyloid is the villain has been questioned. It could be the one who's trying to save the situation, because it has, at physiological doses, it has been shown to be trophic and help the process. So it could be the first one on the scene, and it's the first one on the scene to stop a microhemorrhage.
Yep.
And Jonathan and his colleague Karen Cullen have shown that for every plaque, which is this accumulation of amyloid, there's always a microhemorrhage. So the thinking there is well, it's the bleed. It's the bleed that's the problem, and amyloid's there just trying to save the situation, to limit the bleeding, and that the real villain is heme. You've got, once the bleed happens, the heme becomes free from the erythrocyte, the blood vessel, and heme is incredibly toxic. Under any situation, heme is toxic. And the blood vessel has encapsulated this as a protective mechanism,
right,
but using it to absorb oxygen out in the circulation. But once it's in the brain, that breaks down, you've got free heme around, and it's the heme that's causing the damage.
Is that because of the Fenton reaction that's going on, generating hydroxyl radicals?
I'm not sure, Cameron.
Because I know
sounds iron, right.
if iron is not bound, is not protected properly, it redox cycles with oxygen to create hydroxyl radicals.
There you go. Yeah. That's probably, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why things like copper and iron are so well tightly regulated in the body, is to cycling. Yeah.
That's so with regard to that, and you know, I since I've heard that story, I'm starting to question where alpha synuclein's got the same problem. It's, you know, every trial that's been with the antibodies to alpha synuclein has failed.
Mm.
And I think this bandwagon that, you know, particularly a lot of the funding bodies will not fund you unless you're working on alpha synuclein. And that's been a huge drawback, particularly as well as with the amyloid mafia, that unless you're working on amyloid and the toxicity of amyloid, you won't get funded. And that's been, it's almost criminal, really, that other avenues haven't been explored. I think people are starting to question this mischievous protein type of issue, and even for Parkinson's disease, you've got to think, are we talking about a vascular problem here as well? And I think there is evidence that there are vascular problems in nigra associated with the disease, they're the similarities. Age is, the biggest risk factor for both of them. You know, what triggers them, we don't know. It's just been such a slow process.
My idea is generally that the body doesn't make mistakes. It's pretty damn good at what it's doing. And if you perceive something to be a mistake, then you're the one that's probably wrong. And I think you're right. It's a real shame that we're not able to pursue these other routes of finding out what's going on. And that has to do with just how funding is dealt with these days. And hopefully we can get more people like you looking into the real things.
But thankfully, just on a bright note, leave on a note of optimism, and that there are a number of journals that are, particularly for the Alzheimer's front, that are considering not accepting more alternative hypotheses, and starting to realize that the amyloid hypothesis is not, is probably there's problems with it, and not accepting papers that promote the amyloid hypothesis. So that is a good news, I think, for further progression.
Well, that's the perfect way to end. I don't want to get any more bad news.
Sorry, I wasn't able to answer a lot of your questions, because I really don't.
No, sometimes the musing is more important than having answers, I've found. So I'm just really glad that I was able to ask you questions, and at least you knew what I was talking about, even if you didn't have any answers, because no one's got any answers. But it's good to just sort of put ideas out there. I think this type of information is actually more desired than you might think. There is a growing community of people out there who are really interested in the biological impacts of biophotons and what's going on in the brain with neurodegeneration and how particularly red light therapy is involved in all of this. So I think people will be interested to hear what you have to say, regardless of whether we got any hard endpoints. This was really good. I was really looking forward to it, and it was even better than I thought it would be. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Cameron. And the world, I think science needs more people like you.
Thank you.
That's, just think out of the box and keep doing what you're doing.
That's a massive compliment. We'll have to touch base in 6 months once you've got these photomultipliers up and running.
I'll look forward to it.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. If you're interested in John's work, I've left links to his book and a couple of his salient publications in the episode notes. If you'd like to support the podcast, please subscribe so you can get notified whenever I release a new episode. I also encourage you to leave a 5-star review or give a thumbs up if you liked it. This is a simple, no-cost way to support my work and help me reach more listeners. Please feel free to leave comments on my YouTube channel, as I do try and read through as many as I can. I've put links to all my social media platforms in the episode notes if you'd like updates about the podcast, information about health, or if you'd just like to reach out to me in general. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.